It's so good to be here this morning with you. I can't even tell you. I'm just delighted. And it's kind of nice to have a rainy day, I think, said like a true Minnesotan. But the Seattle summer is so gorgeous, and it allows us to worship in such an infinite variety of ways that may or may not include this particular building. And it makes it even feel grander that you're here with me this morning. Today, I wanted to tell you about a time a few years ago when I was lost, as I talked about with the kids, and it was a little beyond the state fair. I was very lost. But as I said, I think this happens to all of us from time to time, whether on purpose or through happenstance or inattentiveness. We find ourselves beyond what we know, and suddenly we are just kind of out there, dangling in the wind. And in this particular case that I want to talk about, I stood on a hill looking back and forth between a map in my hands and the landscape all around me and finding absolutely no connection between the two. I was somewhere in the Barren Lands, which are above Canada, but I had no idea where in those Barren Lands. The Barren Lands, for those of you who don't know, is a name used to describe the huge expanse of wilderness that stretches between the Canadian provinces and the Arctic Circle. It is a wilderness not because anybody has set it aside, but because it's so remote and difficult to live in. The Inuit have survived there for thousands of years, despite harsh winters and the fact that there's only ever, throughout the summer even, 6 inches of soil that is unfrozen. But their presence doesn't seem to mitigate the vastness that surrounds them. A sea of mostly treeless tundra and lakes and rivers, all of which during the winter, 8 out of 12 months, the winter, is covered with snow that is so windswept it is as hard as the concrete that C.J. Haast was writing about. The Barren Lands, I have to say this, are beautiful. But not in the way that like Rainier is beautiful, you know? It is a place that sits quietly by waiting for you to notice it. Not calling your attention to it grandly, but just waiting quietly for you. It's a place that seems to call a person more towards what I recently heard somebody call lateral transcendence, which is just a great word or phrase. And that what the person meant is elevation or gaining ground or rising above it all, and that's kind of what we think of with transcendence, that is not as relevant as being able to hunker down and fit into the landscape around you. And this is the sort of thing that the Barren Lands seem to call out from you. The flowers are so small and unobtrusive that you have to like lie on your belly with them a couple of inches from your nose to look at them. The tundra is a carpet of small plants, never more than a few inches high, that change color in the fall just like a forest. It smells really good. If you lay your newly washed underwear out on it, it comes away smelling like eucalyptus, no kidding. It's delicious. But not the underwear, but the smell. Stay on the page. There are no trees. So for much of the time, and this is weird, I can't tell you how weird, you are the biggest thing around. Until you round the bend on a herd of caribou or muskox, and then you're just like shocked back into your smallness. Or when you're standing on a hill looking out at miles of vastness. And then you become teeny tiny small. And that is where I was, standing on that hill, looking at the vastness, feeling really, really small. So it was day 17 of a 45-day canoe trip. And I was the designated leader for this group of 17-year-old young women. There were about five of them. About five. It's like I lost track. as the story progresses, you'll be like, oh, yeah. who are presently waiting below me with the canoes, looking like little Monopoly pieces. And this is like our third day lost, third day, not knowing where we are at all. And the amazing thing is that they held on to this deep and abiding confidence that I was going to keep them safe. No problemo. That, you know, I do not know if they knew that as I stood up there on the hill that I had completely run out of ideas, that I was crying, that I was this mostly grown-up woman muttering over and over, Mom? I mean, seriously, Mom? I think they fully expected me to come down from that hill having figured it all out. Now, I don't claim to know how Moses must have felt coming down from that mountain with the word of God carved on stone, his circumstances being slightly different than mine. But I still read that story through a lens of profound anxiety. At many points in wilderness travel, skills and preparation cease to matter at all. And the ability to not panic and breathe is what actually helps. Well, I waved broadly down at the little dots below me just to buy a couple more minutes. Understand, no cell phones, no radio, like you're beyond range of all that. Only the dreaded EPIRB. Now, I don't know if any, do you know the EPIRB? Some people are nodding, but with a dreaded look on their face. The dreaded EPIRB is a fluorescent orange metal box with this long folding antenna, and it has one switch. I think they figure when you're in these situations, you can only ever manage to flick a switch. And when you flick the switch, it sends out a sonar signal that reaches the Canadian Mounties, looking like the signal from a downed plane. Then the Mounties, based on some long-standing agreement, call the American Air Force, I'm not joking you, and then they dispatch the Thundercat. This huge aircraft with hover capabilities that would come looking for a downed plane. And what they would see in this case, however, would be six women in brightly colored rain jackets waving canoe paddles furiously. Now, we're not going to die in this situation, I don't think, unless it's of embarrassment. But it would create quite a stir and quite an expense. And the worst possibility is that this EPIRB that had been sitting in the bottom of one of the packs for 17 days wouldn't work. So unless circumstances changed, we were out of options. No planes flying overhead, no North Star. We hadn't seen anyone but each other in 17 days. Now, if you've been lost even for an hour, maybe in a new city turning down one ways over and over again, or maybe as a five-year-old in the mall, you know this feeling, this desperate, humbled, lonely, afraid feeling. It's mostly a feeling of uncertainty, of feeling that your fate has been taken out of your hands. It's a common feeling people have in the wilderness. And not just the physical wilderness, but also the other kind that C.J. Haast wrote about. The wilderness of grief, of aging, of any transition. Both kinds involve this recognition that most of the trusted footholds are gone and that you've relinquished a certain amount of control and can't be positive about how it will all turn out. Both wildernesses will squeeze heartfelt prayers out of the most agnostic of us, just in case, right? So, but on that hill, I wasn't being that philosophical. Part of me really wanted to go back to the place where we knew where we were, but I knew that that would cost us time we didn't have. And at the same time, I didn't want to keep getting more lost by moving forward in desperate grasps at foundness. Now, as I told the kids, in trainings, they always tell us that if you're lost, you should just sit still and wait or yell. And sitting still, as it turns out, is so counterintuitive. Yelling comes easier. But something moves you forward even when you are acutely aware of how badly it could all turn out. This is human nature. We just keep going forward. I think of John Cobb, the process theologian who calls God the call forward. Like there's just something in us that drives us forward. And, it is the hardest thing, I think, in the world to believe that the thing that could put you back on the map may not be your ingenuity, your work ethic, or your intelligence, or even your stubbornness. That it may not have anything to do with you. So what's the draw of these trips, of the going out there? Why do people go to so much effort to put themselves in harm's way when it's perfectly willing to come to you? Like, to be wet and cold and blistered and frightened and bug-bitten and lost, some people putting their lives at risk to do this. And it's not like fools like me, just fools like me, or some of you back from a last-minute trip to REI and off on our way. It's Native Americans who for thousands of years have walked out into the wilderness to Vision Quest. It's Jesus. It's John Muir, who walked all over everywhere and ended up in the Sierra Mountains, waving on the top of pine trees in windstorms. There is something that compels us to go into the wilderness despite its hazard. It may be something, I think, to do with what's available to us when we are in a situation that exists outside the bounds of our or any human's control. The wilderness of the Bible is a place that tests us, frustrates us, scares us. However, it is also the place, not coincidentally, where God speaks to people. You notice that in the Bible? That's where God actually talks to people, is when they're in the wilderness. God waits to speak while the wilderness brings us to essential questions. Like, how did I get here? How will I survive? What can I place my ultimate trust in? What is this crazy, beautiful place about anyway? And will it dish out more than I can take? The wilderness experience directs our focus to what really matters and can offer glimpses of life that are worth the whole trip if you can stay with it. Stay present to it, even as it is confusing us and scaring us and exhausting us. So on the night before I stood on that lost hill, Lynn and Erica, two of our group members, took out across the tundra on a post-dinner hike to make a sketch of the surrounding area in order to see if it matched up with any place on the map. Pretty smart, right? This is our new strategy. Then I separately also looked around for clues, but what I found instead were these huge grizzly bear prints. And I don't know if you've seen them, but they're huge. in the sand, not far from where we had made camp. And for an hour and a half, I imagined telling Lynn and Erica's parents that I had not only gotten them lost, but eaten as well. And when they finally emerged out of the rolling orange sunset that is the Arctic night at that time of year, they were chatting happily and tried to drag me off to a small pond nearby that was filled with unidentified birds. Completely oblivious and totally happy. This was typical of those days we spent lost. We found things. Our awareness of the shape of the land was heightened. We spent time gathered around the map as if around a flame, and in an effort to brainstorm together, found a deeper sense of connection, really. Now, don't mistake me. We had moments of really intense crankiness. But overall, I'd say our differences were muted in the presence of a mutual predicament. We noticed the subtlest changes in current or elevation. Our search for clues in the environment drew us out of ourselves and into an encounter with the wild and essential world around us. We had fallen off the map and into real wilderness, a place with its own eternal rules, a place of tremendous power, of beauty, and of mystery. So the wilderness, you may know, does not tread lightly around us. It sort of ignores your feelings or your readiness for whatever it's bringing. And sometimes, though I know better, I swear the wilderness is trying to beat down my doors with wind or unrelenting heat, burning cold. And I think a lot of times it succeeds. It all comes around and the tree-snapping storm passes. And finally, I am just there with all my windows and doors blown open, swelling up with sunshine or warm soup. And I swear I am gentle and focused on the things just as they are, like a Buddhist monk having just completed prostrations and attending entirely to the meal in front of him. And I feel totally in it and of it. This is that lateral transcendence. When you are not above it or through it or over it, you are in it and you are of it. And there is no richer place to be. This is what we go out there for, to have an encounter with the nature that Ralph Waldo Emerson always capitalizes, the divine, the lifebeat of existence, the very boundary of our humble and holy beings. These are the experiences that I hold close to my heart when I'm in emotional wilderness. I try to hope for the holy, to know that even though the environment seems hostile and I can barely focus on the terrain just ahead, that soon enough, I may find my way out or trip upon some unexpected piece of beauty. When it's really bad, I try to remember to sit still and breathe. And sometimes I can even bring myself to call for help. And I try to remember that the forest at least knows where I am. Soon enough, it or someone else will find me. Sometime, one of you maybe. At some point on that hill, I stopped crying, only because it wasn't working, and started breathing. Miracle. And soon after, I could hear my group calling to me. So I turn, I look at them, and then I saw what they saw. Two red canoes speeding across the other side of the lake. No kidding. Whoever they were, they seemed to know where they were going. So I barreled down the hill, and we frantically loaded ourselves into the canoes, and we made chase for a good hour and a half, screaming at the top of our lungs the entire way. For a while, I thought they actually might be running from us. We did not catch them until they stopped for lunch. And then there they were, sitting serenely on the beach, eating pasta salad. Really? Pasta salad? Come on. Looking reassuringly cool. They had all the right stuff on. And we paddled up and tried to make a mellow approach. This is kind of the unspoken protocol in the wilderness. And after some pleasantries, I admitted our situation. We'd been lost for 3 days. So I asked them, "Do you know where you are?" They pulled out the maps and explained that this year had seen the heaviest rains on record, and that as a result, the lakes and rivers in this mostly flat place had swelled out of their banks and assumed new shapes, and streams that were supposed to run into lakes were forced the other direction as the lakes spilled out into them. So we had mistakenly turned up one of these streams thinking it was the entrance to our next river. We thanked them for this clarification with a precious half pound of French roast and made our way in a new direction. It only took a day to unlose ourselves. And soon we were returned to our couches, our root beer, our fresh fruits, our hot running water, and a world of other comforts that we call home. The comforts of home are really important, but the illusion of the ultimacy of human affairs is totally dangerous. It is no wonder that we continue to carve away at the wilderness, because we live so much under this illusion that human creation matters most. Howard Zahnitzer, who wrote the Wilderness Act of 1963, which protects a ton of beautiful land in this country, said, "We deeply need the humility to know ourselves as dependent members of a great community of life. Without the gadgets, the inventions, the contrivances, this was in 1963, can you imagine now? Whereby people have seemed to establish among themselves an independence from nature. To know the wilderness is to know profound humility, he said. To recognize one's littleness, to sense dependence and interdependence, indebtedness and responsibility. This, I think, is what's so hard for us in this culture where we have been made so powerful and so almighty. We know deep down that we are not, that we depend always on each other and on the world that feeds us and offers us up beauty upon beauty upon beauty. There is something else that thrives in that vastness too. Even Richard Nixon called it the breathing space of our nation. That something matters that exists there, even if we never visit those particular places, because we are connected to those places. Our lives exist because they do, because those places exist. In wilderness, said Henry David Thoreau, is the preservation of the world. But still, we sometimes do not show respect for life's wilderness, not only chipping away at rainforests and deserts and waterways, but also by surrounding ourselves with environments that don't challenge us, by resisting change, by rushing on or turning back. But when we do this, we deny ourselves encounters with beauty and revelation and unity, and we risk the whole of life. I am aware this morning that you may never make it to the barren lands or any other woodsy wilderness for that matter, and frankly, I don't think you need to. There is so much beauty to be had on your back porch or just down at the shore. Emerson knew that. He spent most of his time on his back porch. But there's a reason that wilderness holds fast as a meaningful metaphor. We needn't drag ourselves to the Arctic to know its power. For some, there is enough revelation and encounter available in our interactions with humanity, or in our grief, or in our times of transition when we have left something and its cozy familiarity, but we have not stepped fully into the next place. In these times, we can find unexpected beauty, having been shaken more fully awake, right? We are humbled by our fear. We surprise ourselves with our ability to keep moving or wait for grace in the face of really, really poor odds. Ultimately, we can fight our wildernesses. We can try to subdue it. We can use it up. Or we can cooperate with its mystery and observe it and let it find us.